Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I got to remind you, folks, that debt is fraud. As a matter of fact, as long as we let them do all the things they have no authority to do, they're going to continue spending money to do it. You know, money being that necessity of being able to act, being able to apply, being able to do something. So anyway, I got a bit of content to get through. And I know this is just building off of Friday's feedback regarding the Electoral College. Now we got a petition coming forward that is going to highlight the fact that Kamala Harris is not a citizen of the United States. There's no evidence that she's ever become a citizen. Now, if we find evidence that her father, now, I don't know what the current law is, but we're going to show you what the law was in 1790 and 1795, because I'm going to read it, and I'm going to share this, and we'll post this up on the content that we've covered so far. So as we look at these naturalization acts, right, to establish a uniform rule, we're going to really dive into this. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to provide you, I'm not going to waste my time and your time in reading the annotated Constitution. Now, we've mentioned this, but we don't talk about this a lot. But in Why Counties Matter Most, I actually highlight this in that article, that the fact that the federal government has created an annotated Constitution is blasphemy. What's a better word for it? It is the evidence of the perversion of how they have basically moved forward with all the noble intent in the world, right? Remember, noble intent is the highway to hell. As a matter of fact, George Washington warned us to not allow noble intent or good intentions to be the method of violating our Constitution. And so we have the right and we have the legal authority as states, as the states in this union, they have all the authority to force the federal government into compliance. So this is what Republic Review is all about. And this is why we tell you that that debt, it's a huge problem, but it's not a problem that can't go away. The states have all the authority to fix this problem. Your state legislatures are allowing America to be destroyed, just like your counties are allowing your states to be destroyed. This is why we cover these resolutions. And we do cover this, as a matter of fact, with Tammy Young, who is going into her primary tomorrow, I believe. I hope everybody had the opportunity to contribute to her campaign, because here we actually had and we interviewed one of the only candidates that actually committed themselves to a pledge. Now, I've had a couple of other candidates technically, have committed themselves, but they didn't commit themselves all the way. In other words, they didn't go get it notarized. They didn't go get it signed by the sheriff or something of that magnitude to say, I want you to hold me accountable. That's what we need in our public servants. We need people that are so forthright in letting you know how they are going to behave as your public servant. We need to make sure that those are the people that get elected. We have to change our paradigms. We can't just keep on voting Republican, and we can't vote who's the most conservative. We have to start voting for champions for the Constitution. It's that simple, folks. This is why I really upset all the conservatives and all these pretentious and pompous, you know, Republicans out there. Oh, well, this guy is just, you know, he's making us look bad. But you know what? Welcome to America. You can be held accountable. The problem is you're not willing to hold other people accountable because they're your friends. I see, and it's constant. I see it all the time, and I've seen it this year. I saw the in crowd going on their private jet or standing in front of the private jet that they were going to fly into, where was it, Wisconsin, where the RNC had its convention. And so we see all of these people at the convention. This is the in crowd. Oh, we were the ones that were selected from the state convention. And so we're the beloved. You can trust us because we're the most conservative. And it's almost like it's a party. What's the difference between the Democrats? Because to them, politics is a party. It's a war for them, but it's also a party. Because they use the political process and the party process to protect themselves. It's almost like they create this immunity, almost the way our public servants are immune. Now, you're the lowest, you know, at the party level, you're the lowest in the food chain of politics. You know, once you get elected, then you're above the law completely. And they will not hold each other accountable. And that is where it has to change. It's not about the perks, folks. It's about your liberties. It's about saving our liberties and this beautiful hybrid constitutional republic that we were given by the divine hand of providence. So, and as you can tell, my voice is strained because I've been doing a lot of strenuous emphasis in conversations. And so all that being said, we've got a lot that we're going to cover today. But before I get into the things we're going to cover today and on Friday and so forth moving forward, I know that there's some of you that have gone to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you haven't been able to get in because you get this security problem that says, hey, you know, that site's not available. It comes up with, and I'll give you one of the errors that you'll see, because when you really see it, you go, oh my gosh, you know, what the heck's going on here? And it basically says this site can't provide a secure connection. And so when you read the details, it says error, E-R-R underscore S-S-L. That's, I forget. These are the secure certificates that Google came out with about 10 years ago. They said everybody's got to start getting certified. They got to get their certs so that your site actually has the certs. And so it's an SSL protocol error that you're getting. Well, if that's the case, go into your security settings and say, ignore that. I'm happy with going to an HTTP colon. See, the new secure sites actually have HTTPS because if you fill out the security form for your certificate, the Google required certificate, then you actually, you know, get blessed because you've registered with the God of Internet. Our creator. And I'm telling you, Google did not create it. Google has been working and working and working in creating a dominance of information. And this is how they're able to shadow ban sites and so forth. Folks, it's only going to get worse as they move closer and closer with Windows 11. Windows 11 with this new trusted platform, I'm convinced, I'm not even playing with it yet, but I'm convinced that they're going to be able to start doing all sorts of things and monitoring you as well as keeping you from obtaining access. Because if you're a trusted platform, then you're not going to be able to touch or connect with other trusted platforms. Or there may be some consequences that you don't even know about. Bottom line, they're getting to a point where they are creating these little barriers, and they're going to create their little alcove, where, you know, you're in this protected realm. You go out of that, they can't trust you anymore. Or you become highlighted, they're going to monitor you, they're going to make sure, what the heck is this person doing? And as hard as it is, there are reasons why, just on principle, I am not going to do an SSL certificate. And so, anyway, all that being said, let me just let you know that reclaiming the Republic is still out there. Now, we may find somebody that will create the facade for this secure, this SSL certificate. The reason why they, you know, and people care about this security is because if you go into a secure site and you're going to give them your private information, you're going to give them your banking information, then this is the first minimum. You have to have an SSL so that you can have some level of security. And then on top of that, you want to actually have encryption and so forth. And so in some cases, when you go into an e-commerce site with the SSL, you'll actually see that little lock that, oh, you're in a secure connection. And so when you do a transaction, you buy something on the internet with Amazon or some other website, you'll notice that up there in the browser URL and what have you, it'll actually communicate to you the level of security and the type of security they're using. So why do I not care about that? Because I'm not here to sell you anything. As a matter of fact, we're a locked down site and we've been hacked before and it's been problematic, but We've been on top of that for a little while, and we're improving. We want to move towards something that will interface with your phone. But the fact is, we're not going to kowtow, and we may actually create a shell SSL going down that path, because everybody wants your phone number. They want to have access. They want to know who you are and how they can get a hold of you, just like that. And so they're becoming less and less tolerant to autonomy. Yeah, you got to be in the board. So anyway, we're here dying, or I'm saying we're dying a slow, it's kind of like the death of paper cuts, right? 1,000 paper cuts. But that's how they're coming at us, and that's how they're separating us from you. So just in case you have that problem, check your settings and make sure that you have open settings on this one browser. And as a matter of fact, if you're afraid of the security and everything else, there are other ways of making sure that when you go to a site, because you've opened it up, you can use Norton or other secure virus and web protection and so forth if you want to do that. That helps actually, if you want to call it, remediate or basically mitigate the issues with, you know, going to an unsecure site. But anyway, what we want to cover today is we want to cover the natural born citizen because of this petition that's coming out with going against Kamala Harris, as well as the uniform rule of naturalization and the concept of immigration, because we're going to dive into the Constitution and we're going to basically help delineate the difference between immigration and the importation of people. The Constitution only gave carte blanche ability for the importation of people in the very beginning. And after the first 20 years, all importation of people stopped. In other words, after 1808, that is when the importation of persons completely ended. You have no more protection under the Constitution. The only thing that can happen is people can immigrate. And immigration is a one-by-one. It's the individual who wants to come here Or it could be, you know, the spouse of, you know, a service member who traveled and marries and says, you know, I want to bring my wife back home and she's not a citizen, or my husband, but vice versa, right? And so there is a one-on-one or one-to-one. The individual who is pursuing citizenship has to petition, or basically has to apply to the federal government that they want to become a citizen. And then they have these different rule sets. If you're outside of the country and you want to immigrate to the United States without any connection within the United States, then you kind of go into a waiting pool, because they provide priority to those situations like military spouses or people that already have family here. They want to immigrate to be with their family, that type of thing. But they do allow, and they have a quota of how many people that have no connection to the United States to immigrate here. And it's to be uniform, and it cannot provide an advantage over one to another. Now, we've kind of covered this concept of advantages, and ironically, out the gate, the federal government did create advantages, because the states wanted the advantages. Bottom line, this was baked in. So when the federal government ended slavery, because we're going to show you how only white people could become citizens after, you know, kind of out the gate. Now, it didn't mean that all the black people that were freemen, that were citizens, it didn't mean that they couldn't be citizens, because they were citizens. But bottom line, when we you know, peel the onion back, we're going to see that over time, they wanted to make it harder and harder. And the states actually, eventually, by I think 1800 or the early 1800s, New York and other states literally stopped allowing blacks to be citizens and vote. They took their voting rights away from them. Even though they had the rights to vote before, they started incorporating these racist laws because, well, this became the issue of politics as we started moving more and more between the differences between parties. As America in 1898 finally had a true two-party system, the Republicans and the Federalists. The Federalists, really, they weren't racist. They were just big government. And they, you know, they weren't trying to create this abyss, but they eventually started creating this dividing line. And eventually, it was the Democrats, and history even shows this, it was those people of the big government mentality and the Democratic mentality that created the Ku Klux Klan. They started using racism as a way to divide and conquer America. That's always been the method. And when you see a government that was based and designed on zero preference, because we've gone through the ratification base and we've already shown you, and even in the notes on the Constitutional Convention, that the federal government was to be neutral when it came to being able to pick sides. They couldn't provide favoritism towards Mexico over all other nations. Just because they're on our border doesn't mean that they have the preference of being able to get access to immigrate and dominate our immigration. Technically, and we'll dive into this, but what we're going to do is we're going to get into these uniform rules of naturalization and immigration. And so what we have is the very first, I'll call it the rule or congressional ruling. Now, out the gate, the Constitution had all of these different parameters or powers. And so the federal government defined the powers. And even though it wasn't an amendment, it was in their purview, the states could always step in and say, hold on here, you're redefining that from the way it was defined to us during the ratification debates. So the states always have the upper hand in coming in and saying, you can't create these preferences. If they allow it, then okay. But the challenge comes from the states, not the federal government, not from the court, not from the president or Congress. I mean, Congress is usually the culpable, you know, in trying to, you know, create a new law and assuming, but it is common. And the, usually the infraction or the breach in the Constitution has been coming from the courts, because the court is notorious for redefining something that was defined already. A good case in point is the separate but equal protection under the law, or I should say equal protection under the law. They're the ones that came out and redefined that as separate but equal. Oh, yeah, you can have it separate. No. No, as a matter of fact, this goes back to the essence of the ratification debates. The federal government couldn't pick favorites. When it eradicated slavery, all people, all citizens, and as a matter of fact, when it created the carte blanche, you know, I'll just say opened up citizenship or granted citizenship to all slaves as well as Indians. Because all persons born in the states or the United States who were actually under the jurisdiction thereof, and their parents were under the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States. The key thing, and this is, you're going to see this here, under the jurisdiction thereof. So when a person comes from out of the United States and they're visiting the United States, they're not under the jurisdiction. They may be allowed to rent. They may be allowed to stay in a hotel. They may actually be, you know, kept up in somebody's house. That does not mean that they have been granted immigration status. They have to apply. And then once they've applied, there are criterias before they are naturalized. And that's why the Constitution, and let me get to that first, because you'll find in Article 1, Article 1, Section 8, right here, it says that Congress shall have the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. That's it. It doesn't have anything to do with the migration or importation, more specifically. They do not have the authority or power to import people. What does that mean? Well, if there's a country that's in need and there's a whole bunch of people out there, they cannot just block grant all of these people refugee status. Where did that come from? Where did refugee status come from? Folks, it came from the UN. And the reason why the federal government was not allowed to create an importation rule and the ability to create favoritism for one nation over another, other than it would be pretty hard sell if all of a sudden the federal government started granting privileges to communists who want to destroy us. You know what? Did that ever happen? Yes, it did. Nixon opened the door and gave them the most favored nation status and gave them access to America and to selling their goods and a free exchange. And since he did that, China was able to basically change itself from a backwards nation to now a formidable enemy to the United States. They were always enemies. They never, never wanted to become a free nation. It has been very clear that the Chinese Communist Party has always, now, I'm not going to be surprised if I have a problem with this broadcast because we get knocked out, but because that's what China does. They don't like the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press. So China has always had a strategy of overcoming the world and implementing communism and taking dominance and control. You don't think they're serious? Look at the economic control that they have today. And the only reason that they've been able to obtain this, the only reason, the only way they got there is because we subsidized it. It's that simple. So now we're going into a break. So I apologize because I haven't even really covered the Naturalization Act. So we'll get into that as soon as we come back. but I needed to read why there is this limitation on naturalization and naturalization alone. There's no ability for the importation of persons. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so back to the very first Naturalization Act, because within the Naturalization Act, one of the things Congress did was they defined the natural-born citizen. Now, many people think that that person has to be born within the United States. No, that's not true. And as a matter of fact, I have a separate document that basically identifies how they defined a natural-born citizen. And it's actually a small little segment of the very first uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, when they create the rule, this is applied everywhere throughout the states. And so March 26, 1790, United States Congress, an act to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that any alien being a free white person who shall have resided within the limits and under the jurisdiction of the United States for the term of 2 years may be admitted to become a citizen thereof on application to any common law court. Common law court, I highlight that, of record in any one of the states wherein he shall have resided for the term of 1 year at least, and making proof to the satisfaction of such court that he is a person of good character. So I'm going to pause right there. So one of the things we notice is that they already made it that any alien white free person, right? So in other words, they didn't want to create a rule that allowed any person to come here, if they were a slave or what have you, to reside, to somehow sneak away, come to America, and then be turned in. And oh, by the way, they knew they had this real problem. Because within the Constitution, in this constitutional compromise, they basically galvanized the right, the state's right, if they wanted to have a slave state, they could, and that they would protect their property, their slaves, if they happened to flee to another state, that state would have to give them up. Over time, this became repugnant more and more as abolition started to grow. Now, you got to remember that slavery was being applied everywhere in the world, and it was just beginning to start falling out in many nations in Europe. And as a matter of fact, Holland was one of those nations that did not have slavery. But Holland did recognize the right of slavery for the other nations, so that if you took your slave and you went to Holland, and while you were visiting, that slave ran away from you, they recognized your property rights. So in other words, this concept, as we started moving away from slavery, they didn't go, you know, they didn't basically open themselves to say, hey, we're a bastion now. If you want to come here at your own risk with your own slaves, if they can break away from you, then they're free. Because that would have really created inhibitations, or it would inhibit the desire of people wanting to do commerce who were actually engaged in slavery and so forth with Holland. You need commerce, especially back in those days. You couldn't grow things all over the place. They didn't have, due to the fact that there were certain regions that had certain resources and they were just not mature in being able to develop their own or what have you, there was a lot of dependency on this world trade. You know, like oranges, where did the oranges came from? The Mediterranean or what have you. I mean, they weren't natural to the United States. And as a matter of fact, I believe pineapple was a produce in the United States. It was problematic, though, because it was sensitive to cold. And so they always had these problems. So we realized that over time that, there's just certain regions that grow certain foods better. And we realized that in certain places, certain regions, they just don't grow anything, like in the Sahara Desert and so forth. But anyway, let me move on. So they basically laid it out to make sure that they didn't become a bastion of security for all sorts of people who wanted to become free. And they wanted to make sure that within the United States, that you couldn't go from one state to another, because they galvanized that in the Constitution. If you're a slave, you couldn't become free by running to a free state. So the other thing that they also did was they created this little parameter. Well, two parameters, that this was going to be done in any common law court. So in other words, at a county level, state level, or what have you, as long as it's a common law court, it can be done. The other thing is that they required that he is a person of good character. That flies in the face of the give me your criminals, give me your, beaten down, serial killers, what have you, right? I mean, what we see on the Empire, or not the Empire, on the Statue of Liberty, give me your weak, your tired, you're sick, what have you. In those days, when out the gate, they were not open to, they wanted, good people. They weren't open to just the criminals. As a matter of fact, they kind of understood the creation of Georgia being a penal colony, an extension of Britain's penal colony, because they knew that, the people that were there had, some questionable morals. I hate to say it, but it doesn't mean that was fixed. But they knew that those people that they were transplanting from the Britain prison system into Georgia under indentured servitude, since they worked off of their debt to society by being a slave, they were given 10 acres of land. And with that 10 acres, they could grow, but they were not allowed to have plantations, which is why the density of population in Georgia at the time in that small state was a strategic move to create a barrier, or at least a firewall, to keep Spain from being able to march forward into the northern colonies. They'd have to, deal with this population in Georgia. It was a strategic move. And so, understand what and why and how governments behave, because they're trying to create this, you know, this little warning cell of dense population to say, hey, if Spain tries to march north, they'll have to go through them first, and that will arouse and waken everybody and sound the alarm up the coast. Hey, the Spanish are coming. So anyway, moving beyond this, the next part of this, it says, and taking the oath of affirmation prescribed by law to support the Constitution of the United States. Now, in the Constitution, it does not say to support the Constitution. More specifically, in the Constitution, it requires that everybody shall, this is what it says in Article 6, shall be bound by an oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. They knew there'd be other constitutions. Maybe, or at least I know that he knew, the divine hand of providence knew that there would become this perversion, I'll say perversive and subversive annotated constitution, which would actually, you know, completely pollute the intent and the meaning of this constitution. And that's what's happened. But so the language is just amazing that the word this is right there. It wasn't to support the Constitution for the United States. That could have been anything. It could have been, as we see, the annotated Constitution. But no, this Constitution. So as you move on to this, okay, so an oath or affirmation, such court shall administer, the clerk of such court shall record such application and the proceedings thereon. And thereupon, such person shall be considered a citizen of the United States. So you had to take an oath to support the Constitution. And the children of such persons, so naturalized, dwelling within the states, being under the age of 21 years at the time of such naturalization, shall also be considered as citizens of the United States. Now, I believe that changed when we actually started moving the legal age limit down to 16 or down to 18 or 17, whatever it was. But nevertheless, they did naturalize the child with the parent. So here's the question on Kamala Harris. Where's the evidence that either of her parents naturalized? We have copies of the birth certificate, both of them. One was the original, and then the other one changed her name. This is in the lawsuit. We're going to put that lawsuit or the link to the lawsuit up. I would post it on our website, but I haven't been able to talk to Doug Gibbs. He's moved from California to a new state, and he's still, I guess, unpacking or what have you. So as soon as I talk to him, I want to interview him. I want to talk to him about this lawsuit. I want to get the ins and outs on this lawsuit, as well as, you know, what the heck's going on. And if you didn't know, I'll just share this with you. It was Douglas V. Gibbs who invited me to speak with him, you know, and actually became a regular on his show. So that, you know, I actually filled in for him a couple of times. And eventually, I mean, he's the one that kind of got me started in radio. And so anyway, we hope to have him on. Now, actually, let me create this injection. This coming Friday, I am going to air my interview with Renee Holiday. I want to get that out there. So if I don't get everything wrapped up today, we'll have to carry it over till the next Monday, because this is a very interesting interview. And actually, Renee Holiday is, I know she married this patriot that I knew before, and this guy was really a hardcore patriot and a constitutionalist. And he's involved in lots of things that, you know, I can't tell you about. But anyway, nevertheless, we found, I think, a good potential co-host to come in and actually read and go through these documents. So hopefully after the ratification debates, if, you know, because I'm looking for, just letting you know, I'm looking for somebody to come in to read the Whiskey Rebellion, to read the Assumption Acts, and all of this other content moving through the rest of the year. Because I know Paul is pretty busy with, you know, moving the cause of liberty forward in Missouri. Because doing a show takes time. It takes a chunk out of your week, out of your day, what have you. Now, back to this March 26, 1790 Naturalization Act. And this is the other part I highlighted. And the children of citizens of the United States be born beyond sea or out of the limits of the United States shall be considered as natural born citizens, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to persons whose fathers have never been resident in the United States. So in other words, if you're a United States citizen guy and you traveled abroad as a minor, and a good case in point would be John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams was a young man, I think he was 12 or 14, when he went to Europe with John Adams. And actually, for a while, he stayed in the care of Thomas Jefferson in France while John Adams had to go to Holland and so forth, and until later on they were able to, you know, be together. And I think Abigail kind of visited him as well. But nevertheless, the point is that John Quincy Adams, had he stayed abroad and actually took up, and I think he did, I'm not sure if he came back to the United States to reside when he became an emissary for the United States government, because he learned from the best. I mean, both his father and Thomas Jefferson taught him the duties of an emissary. And so, I mean, he was a shoe-in, right? He was a legacy. Anyway, so when he finally came back, you know, and he started residing, then his children, had he married and had children, his children would be natural-born citizens after he resided. Had he got married overseas to a, you know, a French gal or some other European gal, and they had children, those children would not be natural-born citizens, because at that point he had not been a resident of the United States. Shall be considered a natural-born citizen, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to a person whose father have never been resident in the United States. Now, the last line is, provided also that no person heretofore proscribed by any state shall be admitted a citizen, as aforesaid, except by an act of the legislature of the state in which such person was proscribed. And so, what do we mean by proscribed? Now, that's kind of an interesting word. In other words, they were prohibited. They were banned from being a citizen within that state. Right? Is that, because that's what it says. Provided also that no person heretofore prescribed by any state. In other words, you were banned by a state. And because they pissed, you got pissed off and they kicked you out and they said, you can't live here anymore. You cannot be a citizen in this state. Boom. Then you could not become naturalized in the United States. You actually, what would require to clean the slate would be an act, because that's what it says here, an act of the legislature of the state in which such person was proscribed. So, as we kind of move into the January 29th, 1795, this is how this one goes down. Third Congress of the United States and the second session, so this was the final year of the session, or of this Congress alum, begun and held at the city of Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania on Monday, the 3rd November, 1794. An act to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and to repeal the act heretofore passed on that subject, in other words, of 1790, for carrying into complete effect the power given by the Constitution to establish a uniform rule of naturalization throughout the United States. Now, okay, so they created, out the gate, they created an act. And that act was pretty clean and pretty simple. Now Congress wants to come along and change that act. They can do so as long as they don't empower themselves with a power that's not delegated, like creating the ability to, import the importation of people. As long as within this act, they don't grant themselves the power to import. In other words, instead of doing just a one by one people applying to them to migrate, to immigrate to the United States, if the federal government said, we're going to be able to import a block of Britons, British people, a bunch of spies, no way. They could not do that. That is not something that was enumerated. The only enumeration of importation of people was given to the states for 20 years. The reason they did this was to ensure the rehabilitation of the slave business, because the southern states complained that they needed to import slaves to rebuild their plantation, and they needed 20 years to do this. Now, as near as I can tell, they did this to actually create, because I told you, and you've heard me say this, the first franchise of America was plantations. Because as a parent who had the money and the means to have a large plantation and a lot of slaves, the next thing that they would do is they would actually set up a plantation further east, or moving west, and their children would go and take care of that plantation. And that became their estate, and kind of like a gift, and the oldest son would inherit the original plantation. So in other words, they made sure that they blessed all of their sons with this savory, or I should say unsavory, plantationness of slavery. And so this became a franchise of these families, which is why there were like 900 families that were involved in the secession of the southern states. And these were the big influential slaveholders and plantation owners that said, we're going to succeed because we have to protect our business. In other words, the millions of people in the southern states that had formed since 1789 into 1860, right? 80 some years as the nation had grown and all of these southern states had been joined into the Union and all the people thereof were subscribed to war because these 900 families wanted to protect their franchises. So, how is that any different than the military-industrial complex? The slave-industrial complex was probably the first complex that we actually had that was moving and putting their finger on the scale of justice to give them advantages. And when we got rid of that thumb on that scale, it just shifted to somebody else, to somebody else, to somebody else, to somebody else. What ended up inheriting most of the influence in America were corporations. And that came right after the Civil War. We'll get into that down the road. So be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives back to the Naturalization Act of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that any alien being a free white person may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States or any of them on the following conditions and not otherwise. First, he shall have declared an oath or affirmation before the Supreme, Superior, District, or Circuit Courts of some one of the states or of the territories northwest or south of the River Ohio, or a circuit or district court of the United States 3 years at least before his admission, that it was a bona fide his intention to become a citizen of the United States, and to renounce forever all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potent, state, or sovereignty, whatever, and particularly by name, the prince, potent, state, or sovereignty, whereof such alien may, at the time, be a citizen or subject. So, when you really start looking at who these people have an allegiance to, when it comes to allegiance, they're talking about allegiance of the law of the land, not spiritual law, the law of the land. But we have discovered that there actually are theocracies that do this. Now, we know that the Jewish faith kind of has their own theocracy where they implement, you know, the Jubilee, where every, you know, after 6 years, they're to free their slaves. Those types of things were part of their theocracy. Now, had the Jews actually got away with creating a new state, you know, as a theocracy, I'm sure that they would have inflicted some form of theocracy. But in America, we weren't to be a theocracy. We would not allow somebody to actually say, I want to be a citizen and create a theocracy. We demand our spiritual laws be applied to the land. And that is exactly what Mohammedans do. So in other words, Mohammedans, when they become a citizen, they actually have to swear off their allegiance to that. Whether you like it or not, they cannot become an advocate for in basically injecting these laws. If they did, then they falsely swore to support the Constitution. You can't serve two masters when it comes to the law of the land in a Republican form of government. If you're coming here and importing your own laws and say, yeah, I want to be a citizen and I will support that Constitution, but I'm not actually going to. I'm going to attack it because I want to invoke the Sharia law. Then you should instantly lose your citizenship. It's that simple. And as a matter of fact, there's all sorts of precedents with this, but let me go on. Secondly, he shall, at the time of his application, be admitted, declare an oath or affirmation before some one of the courts aforesaid that he has resided within the United States 5 years at least. So at this point, it's no longer 2 years. The requirement is now 5 years. You have to be a resident of the United States moving forward 5 years. And why is that? Because if you look at this act, this act is 5 years later. And so they had been admitting people for those who had lived here for 2 years. Why 2 years? Well, because technically the Constitution was ratified in 88. And it had been 2 years since it was ratified. So they basically said, well, we'll kind of cover for 2 years on, you know, from now, 2 years before now and out and on. So anyway, let me try to finish this up. Actually, I got a half a minute. And within the state or territory where such court is at the time held, 1 year at least, that he shall support the Constitution of the United States, and he doth absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to every foreign prince, potent, state, or sovereignty, whatever, and particularly by name and prince, potent, state, or sovereignty, whereof he was before a citizen or subject, which proceedings shall be recorded by the clerk of the court. Now, we're going to end it up there, and then we'll come back to thirdly of section one. So when we come back next Monday, we'll kind of wrap this up, and then we're going to get into the details of an importation to compare what is the importation of people versus immigration and naturalization. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.